Great to have you along here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Turning our attention to pancreas cancer, it's projected to be the second leading cause of cancer deaths. May not come to pass, possibly as a result of clinical trials at the UW Health Carbone Cancer Center, where they're working to improve detection and treatment. And we're going to talk about that and more about pancreatic cancer with our guest, Dr. Jeremy Kratz, back with us. He was with us a couple years back, I believe, to talk about this, but back again. He's an assistant professor in the Division of Hematology, Medical Oncology, and Palliative Care within the Department of Medicine of UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Kratz is also a physician scientist at the UW Health Carbone Cancer Center. So do you have someone in your family or you yourself been diagnosed with pancreas cancer? Questions about it? I hope you will join the conversation. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Dr. Jeremy Kratz, welcome back. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you so much, Larry, for having me on today. It's it's really an important time. We often think about August as Pancreas Cancer Awareness Month, but it's really important to have a reminder kind of 6 months or kind of into that next year.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's do some basics here. What's the job of the pancreas in the human body?
Yeah, the pancreas makes a lot of different enzymes that help us break down food. Specifically breaking down proteins and fats is the primary role. But there's a secondary role in the pancreas, and that's making insulin and controlling blood sugar levels. So, historically, the pancreas has played a role in primarily in digestion. It is possible to survive without a pancreas, but it comes with significant lifestyle changes if, for example, our surgeons were to remove the entire pancreas.
So, and pancreatic cancer, I guess there's different forms of it, but what's happening with that? I mean, what goes on?
Yeah. So pancreas cancer, generally, the most common cause is where the lining of the duct of the pancreas develops a cancer. We call that adenocarcinoma is the fancy term, but that's the most serious form of pancreas cancer that we see. Sometimes there are neuroendocrine cells that are a different type that can also form a cancer, and that is truly pancreas cancer. But in general, the neuroendocrine variants are less aggressive. But the challenge with pancreas cancer isn't necessarily always the initial start within the pancreas, but unfortunately, this cancer can spread. It can metastasize, and that's where it becomes more serious and more aggressive.
And I was thinking back to a friend of mine who went in for, he had to get a physical because he was getting some more life insurance, and he was perfectly, I thought, healthy, and he thought he was perfectly healthy, and they said, well, you got stage 4 pancreas cancer.
Mm-hmm. That's a terrible diagnosis.
And so he lived another 7-8 months, something like that. But he went from looking the peak of health to death in a relatively short period of time.
I'm so sorry to hear that, Larry. I think, sometimes what cancer takes away from our patients is the hardest thing. You know, the strength, the day-to-day things that it can take away sometimes are the hardest things and the things that we want to preserve. when we talk about treating this cancer. But thanks so much for sharing about your friend. You can tell that it still hits you a little bit.
Oh, sure.
Just from our conversation here.
Yeah, and he was in his 40s. I'm wondering about the age on pancreas cancer. I mean, I assume it would develop later in life, but
yeah, traditionally it would. The median patient would present sometime in their 60s. But that said, there are individuals that we see in our clinics that can present in their 30s and their 40s, which, you know, I think opens a question to why. And I think that's where a lot of our works in genomics and the tissue microenvironment in the research laboratory, they're really looking to ask the question of why did this happen and how can we help identify individuals potentially at higher individual risk for developing these cancers. We think that everyone, because society is living longer these days, has a higher risk for cancer across time. And so developing strategies to monitor patients with high-risk lesions, and also being in tune and having a good relationship with your primary care doctor is a big part of overall health in general, as well as in the early detection of cancer. If something's new, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's cancer, but working with your primary care physician is really important. And them knowing you is part of that continuity that supersedes the care that we provide in the cancer clinic. It really starts with the primary care physicians.
You know, I mentioned the one friend, but I've been friends with three other people who also passed away from it. And I'm wondering the incidence of it. What percentage of the population comes down with it, so to speak?
Yeah. So in general, this is a rare cancer. It does affect, a few kind of a handful of individuals for every 100,000 in terms of absolute incidence. The challenge is that unfortunately, a majority of patients, may die from this cancer. And that's what makes it so difficult, in terms of its prognosis.
And you mentioned genes, and I'm assuming if you have family history of it, it's probably a concern. At least a couple members probably in your family.
Yep, approximately 10% of individuals can carry a family risk factor for pancreas cancer. Our national guidelines recommend that anyone who is diagnosed with pancreas cancer, that they get a blood test to evaluate for what we call a germline or a hereditary cause for this cancer. And so, our hope is that as time goes on, that we can help prevent this in individuals who, say, have family risk factors and potentially have early lesions that could be identified and could be acted on. Now, that requires a lot of coordination. It requires, being proactive in that. But for that reason, UW Health has a pancreas cancer prevention clinic, which is used to identify high-risk individuals, their families, and is there to really be on the preventative side of this disease.
You can join in with your own questions and comments as we move along with our guest, Dr. Jeremy Kratz, physician scientist at the University of Wisconsin-Carbone Cancer Center. It's great to have him with us. Number to call, 800-642-1234. You can email us to talk@wpr.org. Dave in Spring Valley has something for us. Let's go there. Dave, hi. Thank you for calling.
Talk@wpr.org.
Dave, are you there?
Hi. I'm here.
Yep. Yeah, go ahead.
So my wife was recently diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and we went through a number of tests, and they found that it was not, it had not spread yet, but the tumor had kind of shut off the vagus vein that I guess is in that neighborhood, and the also the oncologist said that the only cure that she has seen from pancreatic cancer with it involves surgery. They checked. She checked with her connections in Mayo Clinic in Rochester, and they said that the surgery is too risky because there's blood vessels that basically went around this stoppage, mm-hmm. and there's too high a risk for bleeding if they try to do surgery. So anyway, she's just started. She's got one chemotherapy session under her belt and another one a week after next. So anyway, I just wanted to get your comments and any thoughts on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, first off, thanks so much for, you know, for sharing, you know, this story. I think that there's a lot of anatomical considerations for this cancer. The hard part is that the blood vessels and the veins that drain the intestinal system, specifically the mesenteric artery and the mesenteric veins, you know, these blood vessels, as well as the portal vein, which is involved in the blood supply to the liver, all of these are really important to maintain the digestive functions of the body. And so, you know, I can't really speak in great detail for, you know, this individual case. But what I can say is that the anatomy is very important and should be reviewed in a multidisciplinary fashion that includes input from the surgeons, the medical oncologists, the pathologists, and the radiation oncologists. You know, as a team, we have kind of an intake tumor board where we basically review every individual case with input from multiple oncologists, multiple surgeons, our radiology teams, and our radiation oncologists. And we think that is kind of the team-based approach that provides our patients a comprehensive view. And, you know, at UW, I can say that we oftentimes have consensus. We work together to provide a patient the clearest path that's not based upon the opinion of an individual, but rather is based upon, you know, the thoughts of our team together. I think that unfortunately, while surgery can control this cancer, if surgery was possible, there would remain an extremely high risk that the cancer could spread or metastasize. And that's true of all stages of pancreatic cancer, which is why within our practices, we've been starting with systemic treatment or chemotherapy if an individual is safe for that treatment plan. So if a patient, you know, has the appropriate health conditions, we oftentimes start with IV chemotherapy in order to, one, kill any cancer cells if they are in the bloodstream already, and two, try and shrink the cancer down in order to reconsider any local treatment options. For example, there are individuals who are more sensitive to chemotherapy, and sometimes in those scenarios, we can decrease the size of the tumor and potentially improve the involvement of the cancer so that it's not right up against or surrounding some of the vasculature. Now, sometimes in these scenarios, we can just achieve stable disease where the cancer remains kind of in place. And that's where oftentimes we use radiation treatments to try and sterilize the local environment of where the cancer is. In general, radiation is better tolerated than surgery in terms of the recovery time. And we have had individuals in our practices that have had kind of durable benefit to radiation treatments. And there are some new technologies about the ways that radiation are given that also need to be kind of reviewed. There's different doses and different numbers of fractions or proportions of that that also are part of that planning, which is a very nuanced view, but is something that we definitely try to provide that opinion back in the context of that initial visit. So when we meet with a patient, it's not just meeting with a surgeon. We generally prefer to have a patient meet with all the healthcare providers kind of on that same day in order to have kind of a finalized plan.
Hmm. Dave, I really appreciate your call here and your story. Thank you so much for being with us, and I hope Dr. Kratz's response is helpful. Thank you very much. Dr. Jeremy Kratz, Associate Assistant Professor in the Division of Hematology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, and Physician Scientist at UW's Carbone Cancer Center. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. Jeremy Kratz, Assistant Professor in the Division of Hematology, Medical Oncology, and Palliative Care at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, also a physician scientist at the University of Wisconsin Carbone Cancer Center. I had a chance several times to interview Dr. Paul Carbone many years back, and it was always an interesting, and he was quite an individual, I'd say that for sure. And a lot of things have changed over that period, probably 30 years ago when I talked with him anyway, in terms of improvement in cancer. We're talking about pancreas cancer, and certainly there have been the results, once you have it, aren't always good, but there has been a lot of work here at the University of Wisconsin campus by Dr. Kratz and many, many others, as he was talking about, the whole team working on how we can have early detection and maybe be able to extend the lives of many people who suffer from it. Mike in Viroqua has a comment or question, perhaps. Let's go there. Mike, thank you for calling.
Good morning, Larry. Good morning, Dr. Kratz. I'm a family doctor in Viroqua. And if you're familiar with the area, our population isn't very large out here. But as a matter of interest, between November of 2024 and January of 2025, I had four patients diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in that short span of time. Two were in their 60s and two were in their 70s, and that has to be one of the greatest statistical anomalies in medicine.
Yeah. Go ahead, Dr. Kratz.
Yeah. I mean, it's so hard because, there is, a large amount of variance in terms of what we see. I guess I would say that at least in the clinic side, we oftentimes see that more patients present around kind of the end of the year, the holiday season, potentially maybe because there are more social interactions or longitudinal social interactions where families kind of re-engage. And I think that kind of represents the importance of kind of a well-connectedness that occurs, within kind of individual communities. And I think that's an important point, is that so often we think about this as stochastically, rare or, something that happens in isolation. But I would argue that the communities that we care for, have opportunities to be very well connected. For example, the University of Wisconsin has a pancreatic cancer task force, which has, a lot of resources for individuals who are newly diagnosed. We have peer support systems. We have a lot of resources that exist. And there are other groups, including PanCAN or the Pancreas Cancer Foundations nationally, that take some of these kind of rare cases or isolated individuals and allow them to really, you know, come together as a community. And we think that that's incredibly important, particularly in settings where individuals don't have a lot of individual support. I'm sorry to hear that within your practice, and for each individual in every family. But I do think that if, you know, someone on this call is listening in about pancreas cancer, it's important to know that there are resources in oncology. We're here to share in that. I'd like to believe that oncologists are partners in this journey, and we're here to support our patients, to offload some of that uncertainty, provide guidance about what things are ahead, and provide some guidance about, of course, the risks and benefits of the things that our patients consider.
Yeah. Well, it brings to mind, we've talked genetics as a factor, but are there environmental circumstances? Brian in Manitowoc is a recovering alcoholic. He assumes he's at a higher risk for pancreatic cancer due to his prior alcohol use, and wondering about the relationship between alcoholism and pancreatic cancer, and I might add just other kinds of environmental issues that may take maybe issues.
So certainly the use of alcohol and tobacco can change the local environment. It can lead to higher incidence of spontaneous mutations that occur within those cells, but also it can change the local environment. For example, if someone has the healthy pancreas that is damaged from the stress and the inflammation that happens from alcohol, those cells, are driven in a way where they have to kind of regenerate or heal themselves. And so, you know, in some ways, there's kind of two dualities that occur in cancer. One is tissue regeneration, which is the ability for tissue to kind of grow back. And then the other is for the immune system to recognize those cells as, say, growing too quickly or growing unchecked. And so this idea of the immune system is critically important, especially because so many cancers have seen advances where we can use the immune system to kill cancer cells directly. We certainly think that's going to be kind of the future of where we're going, and certainly some trials that we have open at the Carbone Cancer Center right now are working hard to bring immune cells that can kill cancer cells directly in contact with them. Currently, we have two active clinical trials for advanced stage disease, and including one for locally advanced disease, where we basically can bring immune cells in direct contact with the cancer cells.
Yeah. Greg in Belvedere, Illinois, we'll give you a chance to join in. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the time. Before I actually start, I want to apologize in advance for what might sound like anger and frustration in my voice. I'm a former Illinois resident. First wife and I got divorced. I met another lady in my travels down in South Georgia. We was married for 32 years, and 1 year she started losing weight, was having digestive problems. Her primary caregiver tried medication. Nothing was working. She sent her to a gastrointestinal doctor. They did two endoscopies, tried treating it with drugs, did a colonoscopy. This went on back and forth with the doctors for nearly 18 months before somebody finally put two and two together and decided to test for pancreatic cancer, which by then it was too late. Now, I had never even heard of pancreatic cancer until my wife got it. After she passed away 2 years ago, I started talking to people at work who had lost relatives to it. And the pattern seems to be the same. It's doctor, doctor, doctor for a year, year and a half, before somebody finally tests for pancreatic cancer. And by then it's too late.
Yeah.
So why, I guess, is what Greg's saying. Why can't people, or why can't the medical facility or the doctors test earlier?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'd like to, believe, Greg, that your story is, in isolation. Oftentimes in medical oncology, we are involved after a diagnosis. And so, I think that traditionally the scan that can make this diagnosis is either a CAT scan or an MRI. You're absolutely right that things like chronic diarrhea, new abdominal or back pain, those are definitely hallmark signs, as well as new onset diabetes. Someone who never had diabetes in their life and in their 50s or 60s spontaneously develops diabetes, that's been shown to be a risk factor for developing pancreas cancer. And so all of that should definitely be reviewed with an individual's primary care provider or with a gastroenterologist. Both of them are critical in working up, the constellation of symptoms that you describe. As far as, why in that individual case, I really don't have an immediate answer for that. I think that it is important that, we are advocates for our patients. It's important that patients and families are advocates for, for one another. I think red flags include weight loss. I think, persistent pain that is not improving. All of those things have to certainly be considered. I really think that this is where partnering with a primary care physician across time is critically important to say, my weight has always been here, and all of a sudden I've lost 40 pounds, or I've lost 10% of my weight without changing anything about what else has been happening. I think those are all very fair and important questions. And I would just encourage that individuals have good relationships with primary care, because really that is where the clinical diagnosis occurs. If an individual isn't getting the answers that they want, I also think it's important to consider a second opinion. And that would probably be through the role of a gastroenterologist. So a provider who focuses on digestive health issues, they are critical, and they oftentimes are the ones that do make a tissue-based diagnosis where they can do a procedure to go into the stomach and into the small intestine and sample an area of the pancreas that ultimately is done by an interventional gastroenterologist.
Greg, I'm sorry for your loss, and I thank you very much for calling and sharing your thoughts. Lauren in Madison, your turn. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for hosting this show. Dr. Kratz, I want to thank you for the shout-out to the Pancreas Cancer Task Force. I'm a member of that task force, and I know that all of the members who are listening right now very much appreciate the partnership and collaboration that we have with the Carbone Cancer Center and all the people that work there. So thank you. My question is about KRAS. My wife is a cancer survivor. She had the Whipple surgery, radiation, chemotherapy. She's about 15 years out from the surgery. One of the things that we learned over the last 15 years through our own experience with the cancer and through the Pancreas Cancer Task Force is the importance of this gene KRAS and how KRAS can play a role in identification and treatment. What is the Carbone Cancer Center doing to capitalize on this research and this knowledge about KRAS? Thank you.
Absolutely.
And maybe you could explain KRAS for us too, Dr. Kratz.
Yeah. So the way I think about KRAS is it's kind of like a spark plug. It's basically a pro-oncogene. It's something that helps the cancer cells grow. but it's something that the cancer can kind of go to at any point in time, because it's kind of the spark plug that can kind of reignite continuously to lead to the cell's growth and proliferation. KRAS can be mutated or activated in greater than 80, oftentimes even 90% of the time KRAS is mutant, which is why we focused a lot of efforts both in translational research and in clinical trials in order to block the signaling of KRAS. There are many different ways to block the signaling of KRAS, and that wasn't true even 3 years ago. 3 years ago, we kind of waited for KRAS to spark, and then we tried to block its downstream pathways. Whereas nowadays, we actually have the ability to block KRAS and also block the interactions that KRAS has with other proteins. And so recently, the FDA had prioritized, I believe it was 9 agents. And one of them is actually a drug from a group called Revolution Medicine that actually blocks many of the isoforms of KRAS. And so the FDA has kind of chosen this agent for an accelerated development process. And so, you know, we are hopeful that the research around this agent and other KRAS inhibitors can kind of provide a launch board to get these in the hands of patients sooner. Right now, I can say at Carbone, within the last 12 months, we've had at least 4 and likely up to 6, even more than that. We've had probably 6 or 7 clinical trials that have focused on different ways of blocking KRAS. The challenge is that, for a given trial, you know, we're trying to offer this treatment for any patient who's eligible. And because there's so much enthusiasm for developing these agents, these trials are somewhat challenging to find the slot. They're very competitive. And so, at our cancer center, we are competing with the large cancer centers, the MD Andersons, the Sloan Ketterings of the world, in order to make sure that our patients here in Wisconsin are offered these agents. And so, it is something where if we're presented with an opportunity to consider a KRAS trial, particularly in a space where we see evidence of activity in other models or in relevant animal studies, we accept that trial immediately, provided that, we have safe guardrails for considering that for our patients. So unlike other disease etiologies where, we may consider 1 or 2 trials, if it's a KRAS trial, we're raising our hand and saying, yes, let's bring this for the patients that we treat. And that's critically important. And we also review regional clinical trials as well to see if there's other slots. But oftentimes, we have kind of matches where patients can be matched based upon a given variant. So with the kind of the flavor of the KRAS variant, we oftentimes have trials that are available for those patients. As an example, we currently have 2 clinical trials that are targeting KRAS G12D. We had 1 clinical trial that was targeting all of KRAS. We, in the last 12 months, have participated in 3 clinical trials that targeted KRAS G12C, which is just an amino acid substitution. But I'm getting a little technical here to say that it's kind of all court press to block the signaling of KRAS.
Yeah. Thank you again for calling. Appreciate your call. Pat in Middleton, your turn.
Yeah, hey, thanks for taking my call. Really interesting. My son had severe pancreatitis when he was in his mid-20s. Ended up hospitalized several days on the ventilator with adult respiratory distress syndrome, and he recovered completely and is doing all the right things now. I think it may have been partly alcohol related, but he's now 40 and very healthy. My question is whether or not that severe episode of pancreatitis would predispose him to pancreatic cancer later in life, and if so, could he have any screening, such as, you know, abdominal ultrasounds done on a regular basis to detect it early?
It's a great question. I think that there's a lot of variables that play into it. We know from studies of individuals who have chronic pancreatitis, which would be kind of recurring episodes that occur multiple times, that they certainly have elevated individual risks across time for developing cancer, pancreas cancer specifically. The challenge is that if this was one single isolated event that occurred, it may not meet that criteria for chronic pancreatitis. Instead, you know, it could be a spell of what we call acute pancreatitis, which is where in a short period of time, someone has inflammation of the pancreas. And so the definition and the timeline of that can impact the likelihood of this conferring it, this individual to have a higher long-term risk. And so, unfortunately, there's limited evidence for a single isolated acute or short-term presentation that would increase an individual's risk. I do think it's a fair discussion, and I think that the risk-benefit of surveillance is one that likely could occur in coordination with our pancreas prevention clinic that is focused on ways of preventing pancreatic cancer.
Pat, thank you again for calling. Appreciate it. Dr. Jeremy Kratz, our guest today, physician scientist at the UW Carbone Cancer Center, talking with him about pancreas cancer. Great to have him with us. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Looking at pancreas cancer today with Dr. Jeremy Kratz from the UW Carbone Cancer Center. It's great to have him with us. And Connie in Madison has something for us, so let's go there. Hi, Connie. Oh, perhaps we lost that guest. Let's instead turn to Tom in Madison. Tom, hello.
Hello. Thank you, gentlemen, for the great show. I just had a question, and I've come in a little bit late on the program, but the role of the liquid biopsy in early pancreatic cancer detection. And I know locally here, Exact Science has developed a test, and I wonder if moving forward, if that would be of any benefit. And of course, cost is always an issue, but I'd like your feedback on that thought.
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say that this time, the challenge is that we can detect a variety of things with liquid-based tests, and it really depends upon an individual's risk factors. I would say that the use of a liquid biopsy or the use of blood-based testing to screen for pancreas cancer is currently a research question. There have been no studies to date that have used those types of assays that have shown an improvement in survival. Now, are there individuals from those types of studies where we picked up variants that are shared or common in pancreas cancer and they've been diagnosed earlier at the individual level? That certainly, you know, has been true. But in terms of randomization, where we've taken, you know, hundreds or thousands of individuals, provisioned them those tests, or established annual follow-up visits with their primary care doctor, those randomized studies, to the best of my knowledge, have not been performed. And so, you know, while this is an important area of research, and I believe there are more blood-based tests to screen for many cancers that are available through both Exact Sciences and GRAIL, the evidence base that those to date have been able to help patients live longer through early diagnosis, that data has not been generated thus far. And so I do think, you know, there has to be some caution because there are other downsides of doing those tests. Those tests will, if positive, necessitate the need for additional scans, additional procedures, additional clinic visits, additional healthcare cost. And so, you know, in terms of using them, you know, outside of where they're indicated or using them for primary screening, I think individuals just need to be informed about the potential downsides of any test, including the ones developed for early detection. I think a lot of it relates to the sensitivity. While there are some cancer genes that we can detect in pancreas cancer that can be detected in the bloodstream, they can be seen for other conditions that are benign or may not confer any change in an individual's course across time. An example is a gene called TP53 that sometimes as we age can change some of the bone marrow cells and lead to a condition called clonal hematopoiesis of indeterminate potential. We call it CHIP. And for example, if we were to pick that up in the bloodstream, while TP53 could be seen in pancreas cancer, it can be seen also as a function of spontaneous mutations in the bone marrow as a part of aging that may not change an individual's course. And so it's really important that we have kind of pathways where individuals can access care. And I know that for some of these newer screening-based tests, we're in discussions right now to find clinical services that can help meet our patients' needs within the community. I would say that as individual providers who treat pancreas cancer, you know, we certainly are available and happy to connect with individuals and patients to provide them the best care. I would say that at this time, that probably should be done in coordination with the primary care physician, because I think the continuity in having that, I think the primary care physicians also should be providing some education back to patients about what the risks and benefits are of these novel diagnostic tools, and also the limitations. I think the limitations have to be clarified. Some patients, you know, more information in that is very important. And that may be a reasonable consideration for other patients who, say, have many other health conditions or already have enough doctor appointments as it is, you know, and the limitations of that should also be considered.
Yeah. And this probably relates to John in Fitchburg's email. He was wondering how good CancerGuard is. That's a new screening test. How good CancerGuard is at detecting pancreas cancer.
It's a great question. So I think, you know, there's a couple different tests. I think the one that we know the most about, of course, is ColoGuard, which was a stool-based test to detect colon cancer. CancerGuard is a new blood-based multi-cancer early detection test that's available from Exact Sciences. It was launched specifically for individuals with no prior history of cancer, and it does have a variety of DNA and protein markers that are included in it to help kind of personalize the potential for cancer to develop. And so, again, these screening efforts, you know, can be available, but I think that individuals should have a shared discussion with their personal physician, with their primary care physician, prior to ordering these tests, because they can result in additional follow-up imaging or invasive procedures. And the ability of these tests to improve survival, I think, is an active area of research right now.
Connie in Madison, what's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. I'm back. Thank you. I'm going to miss you so much. Thank you for doing this show. I was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer about 3 years ago, pretty close to when the pancreatic clinic opened at UW Hospital. And the after my endoscopy, I was told within a week I should have my pancreas and spleen removed. And I was in shock and just kind of needed to meditate on it a little. And so I didn't go ahead with it. And I did, through my research, find that there was a Chinese study that women over 75, their tumors didn't continue to grow typically. And so I chose not to have the surgery. And I haven't had any kind of follow-up or any advice to, that there was a prevention clinic and any advice on building up your immune system or any of that. And I just wonder, why is it, if you choose not to get surgery, are you kind of no longer part of the program? Or and I'm still alive 3 years later, so
well, that's good.
I guess the Chinese know what they're talking about.
Yeah, I would be hesitant to provide, you know, formalized medical advice on, you know, without knowing more details about initial imaging, blood-based biomarkers, your clinical status, all of those things. What I would say is that there are some variants of pancreatic tumors that can be significantly more indolent. And those are the neuroendocrine or carcinoid-based tumors that generally have a slower clinical course. It's possible that is the type that maybe you could have. But that said, I think that providing that perspective via, you know, this call, I think would be premature. And I think there's a lot of factors that go into an individual's course that, you know, that have to be considered. And I think understanding, what do we see microscopically? What do we see on the scan? How has that changed across time? How are you doing? You know, how is your overall health? All of those factors play into the risk benefits of things like major surgery and the likes. And so, you know, while I'm glad that you, it sounds like things have been pretty stable overall, that's great news. But I would just, you know, heed some caution to say that, you know, there could be other explanations for that. And that's where continuity of care and having follow-up and established relationship with your primary care doctor and potentially a surgeon or a medical oncologist, I think that's where we provide, you know, the best care. I think in some ways, oncology is a profession where we get the privilege of having relationships with our patients. And that's something that we take extremely seriously in terms of our clinical practice.
Connie, thank you. And in our last minute, Bob had emailed wondering, are there cures on the horizon for phase four patients?
It's a great question. For individuals with metastatic disease, you know, there remain some challenges to achieve cure. You know, I think that we need better systemic treatments. And that's where the use of both agents that target the cancer, so the KRAS agents, as well as other growth factors that are unique to pancreas cancer, important. And then the other is the ability of the immune system to bring in contact these same targets so that we can allow for the immune system to kind of come alongside and clean up anything else that could be in the bloodstream. Right now, we know that chemotherapy alone is not a cure. You know, we think that chemotherapy can help patients live longer, but it comes at a cost of additional toxicity, low blood counts, infection risk, GI symptoms and the likes. And so we definitely need combination treatments, which is what we're working on in the lab.
Dr. Kratz, thank you so much for being with us today. We'll have him, hopefully we'll get him back and we can talk some more about pancreas cancer and the work of the center there at the UW. They're doing a lot of great work. And thank you for listening. And thanks to Clara Kniper, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins of our team, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, and we ask you to stay with us. Lots more in store on WPR News.